Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
his crazy sidekick, Corey Knockreiner.
Sidekick, I like that. You've been demoted. On today's episode,
I still pay your salary.
Be quiet, sidekick. On today's episode, we have a news roundup. It was actually a really busy news week in the cybersecurity land last year. So we have four different news stories that we are going to be shooting at you right away. So with that, let's jump in. So normally right about now, I'd say, let's start with the news before jumping into our main section. But today, we're actually just going to have an entire episode on a news roundup because it was a very busy week when it came to the news. So with that, let's go ahead and jump in with our first story. This one involves a cryptocurrency exchange. So Tuesday of last week, one of the largest cryptocurrency exchanges was actually the victim of a cryptocurrency breach. They announced they'd been the victim of a hack that had stolen over 7,000 bitcoins, valued at roughly 40 million to, I think, 45 million at the time that we're recording this now.
Wow.
In their blog post, they said the attackers used a combination of phishing and malware to make off with user API keys, multi-factor authentication codes, and then ultimately execute a single transaction that drained Bitcoin from several user accounts that was all managed by a single Halt wallet. So this is a lot to digest, but long story short, this is a pretty massive attack, $40 million, right?
It's crazy. But actually not that uncommon, as we're seeing with a lot of these online wallets or exchanges.
Now, I think I saw the number was, including this attack, cryptocurrency thieves have made off with $400 million in various crypto coins in 2019 so far. That's insane. That's a lot of money. They're on track for almost hitting $1 billion by the end of the year.
And that's just this year. My goodness.
Yeah. So I guess a couple things we should probably break down in this news thing was they mentioned that all of these coins that were stolen were managed by a single Halt wallet. And we should probably go over what a Halt wallet means and how it differentiates from a cold wallet, as it's called. So in cryptocurrency exchanges, they are basically just a bunch of wallets for whatever the cryptocurrency is, which is just a public and private key pair that are connected to the internet in some way. And because there are obviously risks, as we've seen with this hack, with a wallet that has internet access, the majority of the funds are actually stored in what are called cold wallets. So these are public-private key pairs that make up a wallet that are stored offline, typically in a server that's completely air-gapped from any internet access. And at any given point in time, they only have a small amount of funds in their Halt wallet. In this case, I think the hack made off with only 2% of their total funds, is what they said. And that blows my mind that $40 million is 2% of their total funds that they had available at this exchange.
Yeah, but an exchange is kind of like a bank, right? That's a ton of people's money.
Yeah. And you actually bring up a good point there in that even though cryptocurrency has crashed, it's actually kind of rising back up. But even though it's crashed, there's still a lot of transactions and a ton of money in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And in order to convert that into US dollars or other crypto coins, they have to go through one of these exchanges. And we mentioned that $400 million stolen already this year. And it kind of begs the question, have crypto exchanges really matured enough at this point to equal online banking? It really doesn't look like it. You don't see like Bank of America getting hacked for $40 million every day. So what's up with crypto exchanges right now?
Yeah, I don't think they have the technological advancedness to really act as a bank yet. I mean, like you say, they're being hacked. The fact that they're online makes them vulnerable to any security vulnerability out there. I guess banks do have the same problem, but they kind of limit the amount of transactions that are available at customer-facing sites. Like even when I do my online banking, I can't even make, you know, I have a limit to my transactions I can do without being at the bank's branch. So, you know, cryptocurrency is very exposed online, so they have to have top-of-the-line security. And it's clear ever since Mt. Gox, and now we've had endless ones, including this Binance one, it doesn't seem like they're quite ready for prime time.
And it's somewhat understandable since really cryptocurrency is still a relatively new technology. Like banks have been around for hundreds of years, maybe not online banking, but banks have been around for quite some time and they've had enough time for regulations and best practices to kind of force them to be a little more secure. Whereas it kind of feels like a lot of these crypto exchanges and different applications that interface with blockchain are all kind of flying by the seat of their pants, it seems like.
They are. You got to kind of think it's the way Bitcoin was started. If you look at why cryptocurrency was made by the first guy, Satoshi, it was all about a libertarian, non-regulated, non-government controlled currency. And I think you know from my discussions with you, Mark, and maybe our listeners know that whether or not you trust a government to regulate currency, you know, there's actually important benefits to having currency backed by something. And I think cryptocurrency, the way it's made, is to kind of avoid that kind of regulation and government backing, because I kind of want this to be a free libertarian currency. In fact, even based on this Binance hack, I've already seen some articles talking about, you know, I think you'll get into what Binance could have done to maybe turn back this hack, which has to do with cryptocurrency politics. But some people that believe in cryptocurrency say we have to re-go to the beginning and we do not need the help of global capital or regulators, you know. So a lot of them are trying to still keep this decentralized, non-regulated currency. But I just don't see, I don't see why they haven't seen the issue with that so far.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point that with traditional banking, it's still very difficult, but there are ways to kind of roll back fraudulent transactions depending on how they occurred and when they occurred and when they're caught. Whereas with cryptocurrency exchanges and or blockchain in general, once a transaction's on the blockchain, it is there, barring a very drastic intervention.
Yeah, it's supposed to be immutable is the term we use, that immutable. It's there and supposed to be not changeable forever.
Exactly. And interestingly, Binance's CEO actually, right after this attack, as they were trying to figure out what they could possibly do, he suggested something called a reorg of the blockchain. And to describe a reorg, we can actually look back to one that occurred in Ethereum, which is, I think, still the second most valuable cryptocurrency. Very early on in its lifetime, there was this big platform that was built on Ethereum using Ether, their cryptocurrency, called the DAO. The DAO was basically a decentralized venture funding company where people could put in Ethereum and then vote on different Ethereum-based projects. It was actually hacked, though, a month after it went online, and a massive number, like a substantial percentage of people that owned Ethereum had all of theirs stolen by this attacker. And Ethereum actually made the Ethereum community made the really drastic decision to do a reorg. They intentionally hard forked the blockchain, so effectively creating a brand new version of Ethereum, where that hack was basically wiped out. They retroactively went back and changed the blockchain. And this caused a pretty big rift in the Ethereum community. Even though a majority of people agreed to it, which allowed it to occur, there was still a very vocal minority that went on with now what is called Ethereum Classic, which is basically the exact same cryptocurrency, but without that hard fork and with the hack still in place.
And the reason it's a big, big deal, Mark, is for that little period of time. Well, I think a refork does include some of the historical transactions before the problem happened. There are people, like if you consider the reason they're doing it as a hack, obviously the people that lost money from the hack might be happy because they're going back in time with the refork, so to speak. But there could be legitimate transactions, legitimate miners that actually had previously would have made blocks and made some money. The refork also loses all that for that small period of time too, right? And that's why
exactly.
People are kind of mixed about it.
And in order to do one of these chain reorgs, you need a majority of participants in the blockchain, so 51%, to agree to it to happen. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. You see this maliciously in what's called a 51% attack, which actually happened to Ethereum Classic about a month ago or so, where if someone's able to gain a majority of mining power on the network, they have full say on over what transactions go into the blockchain. But Binance's CEO suggested a intentional reorg here that would go back in time and do it. And a lot of people pointed out that that just simply is not feasible on the Bitcoin network. There are so many systems and so much mining power participating in this that getting 51% of them or more to agree to this change is just strictly not possible, was the opinion I saw from most big names in Bitcoin, which I tend to agree with. It would be a massive undertaking. And all things considered, $40 million is a lot of money, but in terms of Bitcoin, that's not actually a whole lot of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like, the only reason I think it worked with Ethereum is because it was like a double-digit percentage of Ethereum that was stolen during this, because it was very early in its lifetime.
Yep.
And one other point I wanted to bring up related to this was there was another cryptocurrency-related thing that happened in December of last year involving another exchange called Quadriga. It was Quadriga CX. It's a Canadian crypto exchange where in December last year, their CEO suddenly passed away, and he was the only one with the passwords to unlock their cold wallets that actually house the majority of their money, which locked up $134 million in cryptocurrency. Now, I think that's bad business practice to have only one single person capable of unlocking all of your funds. But B, it actually gets a little interesting and fishy with all this, where some investigations actually found that most of those cold wallets were drained prior to his death.
Oh,
so it seems like it might be a bit of a cover-up. And so my question with this is, if you were to put on your tinfoil hat and say, all right, so $40 million in Bitcoin was stolen, what would it look like if this was actually an inside job? Like, would we as external analysts be able to identify a inside job hack where someone just embezzles $40 million of Bitcoin from a cryptocurrency exchange? Seems like that might actually be a really big risk for some of these things. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think we could figure it out from the outside. I mean, what we can do, and all that is done, it's done still today, is we can track, you know, when these Bitcoin thefts happen, the Bitcoin's transferred to a different wallet. So as you and I know, Mark, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency transactions are not private. You know, by definition, they're public ledger. So when these sorts of thefts happen, you can actually see the wallet they go to, but then they get broken up into tons of different wallets. I guess the only way you really do this is if somebody follows these thefts enough that they follow all the different wallets they're broken up to and can somehow identify where the Bitcoin ends up and somehow associate that to a person that's associated with the organization in question. That's really the only way I could think of that anyone would ever figure out whether or not there's an inside job. But I feel like this isn't a new issue. I mean, even with Mt. Gox and some of the other breaches, you know, aren't half the time the people using these exchanges or online wallets kind of worried that it really is just the provider that's faking it to keep all their Bitcoin?
It is entirely possible. In the case of this one, it looks like it wasn't an inside job, strictly because the exchange itself, Binance, actually hired a half dozen different companies to try and do exactly what you said, track all of these transactions. And they've had some reasonable success, where some of the funds that originated from this hack have ended up in other exchanges, which were notified and basically locked out those funds so they could not be converted to something else. But it's still there. Most cryptocurrencies revolve around some form of anonymity, and they are difficult to identify the whoever the person is that actually carried it out, even if you can track the transactions, which means there is a legitimate risk of an inside job stealing a bunch of crypto coins and getting away with it. And that's why one of the big recommendations I always hear is exchanges are good and they are necessary in order to swap out your coins for something else or turn them into real cold hard cash, but only put your coins in an exchange for the specific amount you need to transfer to something else, and then make sure that once you've transferred them, you pull out whatever you have left or whatever you received and store it in your own cold wallet somewhere else. Basically, don't use these as banks, because as they've proven, they're not nearly as secure as a bank would be.
Yep. Before you move on, I hear that Binance has got a new CEO. I hear that someone from Deutsche Bank is actually coming to be their new CEO.
Interesting. I did not hear that bit of news.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how it was a past Deutsche Bank executive. I think this just happened, on May 9th. But it'd be interesting to see, more traditional banking people are starting to get into cryptocurrency as well.
Makes sense.
I don't know if that's good or bad, depending on your reasons for using, cryptocurrency, though. Because if you really follow some of the people that made it, it was all about getting away from the banks.
That is a interesting little conundrum that it's starting to come into. But, I'm of the opinion that blockchain technology does have its uses outside of many of the buzzword applications that you see it in. For financial transactions, it is a pretty good way of sending around funds with minimal fees and very high accountability. So it will be interesting to see more and more banks start to use blockchain tech in some way or one another, and lots more crossover of executives from traditional banks to these massive crypto exchanges.
Absolutely.
So moving on now, our second news topic has to do with ransomware. So last Thursday, the city of Baltimore announced that they had become the latest victim of a pretty massive ransomware attack affecting a large portion of their city computer systems. Everything from their 311 helpline to the city council to email systems for things like their police department. Luckily, outside of email, most emergency services were not really affected. One thing I noticed in the report was that it did disable access to the parking fine database. So, hooray.
Citizens rejoice.
But initial reports from this are that it was the Robinhood ransomware that was responsible for this.
Because of the... That's the name of the ransomware.
Exactly. Not because it was locking out parking fine databases for the masses, but an actual strain of ransomware called Robinhood, which I don't think we've discussed previously on the podcast. But some interesting facts about this is it's not like other ransomware attacks we see where it doesn't actually use phishing attacks or automatic network exploitation in order to spread automatically. Instead, most often Robinware exploits things like open remote access to servers or computers like RDP. And then it uses traditional Trojans in order to infect a system. And then from there, use like Active Directory extensions in order to install itself on other systems on the network. So it's a less traditional method of spreading, but it still managed to hit basically the entirety of Baltimore's computer systems, which is impressive from a scary standpoint.
I think OpenRDP is a relatively widespread problem. Malware's been using that for quite a while. And the tie to Active Directory is pretty smart as well. By the way, if anyone wants to know more about the Robinhood ransomware, Bleeping Computer, cool site in general, kind of a forum where you can talk about viruses, they have a good write-up of it.
Awesome. Yeah, and what was I saying? OpenRDP access is really a pretty big issue. A lot of people that might not have like security know-how, or actually quite obviously don't have security know-how, recognize that some of their employees may need to work remotely and still connect to internal systems. And instead of using a secure method for connecting to their network, like a VPN, they just expose RDP access with a NAT rule or port forwarding through their firewall directly to that server. And that opens you up to a huge range of issues, ranging from just if you're using weak passwords, it's super easy for an attacker to sit there, hammer away, and brute force their way in. Or, as we've seen with previous zero-day vulnerabilities in like Windows RDP, it's possible for them just to exploit an unpatched vulnerability and gain access to the system right there.
Yep. Very, very common. By the way, same with VNC server and pretty much any remote desktop server that you keep open to the internet. We recommend, obviously, technical users, the administrators out there, they need RDP. We use it all the time. But the takeaway here is add some sort of add more authentication to it. For instance, with the Firebox one, you could VPN in. That way you don't have to open a port at all. You only allow access to things like RDP via VPN. It gives you extra encryption. Another, you know, harder authentication to break. You could throw multi-factor on top of that VPN. Or with devices like WatchGuard's Firebox, you could even do things like our authentication portal, to force some other login before you even get access to the ports necessary. That said, you know, unless it's VPN or multi-factor, a lot of these issues hinge on, you know, what they tend to do with RDP if they don't have an exploit for it is to brute force. So use strong passwords at the very least, no matter how you're exposing it.
Yep. So this is the second major municipality after Atlanta in recent months to get hit with a big ransomware attack. And it kind of begs the question, are like big cities set up in a way to protect themselves from ransomware attacks? I mean, it cost Atlanta millions of dollars and issues because of their hit. I imagine Baltimore isn't going to be much better off. What do you think is like preventing these cities and all their systems from being protected from these types of attacks?
Well, obviously very little. I think a city is like a unorganized small business, and I even say unorganized, right? I mean, they have a lot of resources online, and they have to have public resources because as a city, they serve a community. But if they're not spending the budget on their IT security, they're, you know, they're as defenseless as a small business. Just because they're technically part of a government doesn't necessarily mean they know what they're doing as far as cyber is concerned. So I don't know if you've probably visited even our city's websites and resources. They're not particularly advanced, or in some cases, they're kind of older than some of the technologies we'd use. So I imagine their security is probably the same.
Sometimes it feels like stepping back into the early 2000s when I go into one of our city's online systems.
Yep. And if you think about it, these systems are all kind of separate organizations on top of that.
And it's somewhat understandable, too. Like, they don't always have the budget dedicated to IT, but it seems like they might need a rebalancing. Obviously, Atlanta and Baltimore did, and I'm sure they're not the only ones out there.
For sure. And by the way, it goes along with some of our predictions. I think we've seen ransomware hit healthcare for a long time. We saw the SAMSAM ransomware hit Atlanta, and that's in part why we started predicting that ransomware authors are no longer trying to get everyone. They're finding types of organizations, whether it be a city, a hospital, industrial control facility, an energy facility, manufacturing plant, something that has really strong ties to their technology, and uptime. If their technology goes down, critical things happen. So I think this just goes to show that ransomware authors really are targeting any type of organization that relies on their technology strongly.
I think you're right, because this Robinhood ransomware that was supposedly used in this attack isn't one of those carpet bombing ransomware attacks that we see going after literally everyone. It is a much more targeted ransomware attack. And like you said, we've predicted that these are probably what we're going to see going forward more often now. Now, moving on to our third topic in our busy news week. This one actually started in 2015. You might have heard of a little breach back in that day, affecting a major healthcare insurance provider called Anthem. Well, on Thursday, U.S. prosecutors charged two Chinese nationals for the 2015 Anthem breach, as well as three other unnamed companies that were breached around the same time as well. If you're not familiar with the Anthem breach, back in 2015, is around 78 million records of U.S. citizens with very sensitive information, including the obvious names, phone numbers, social security numbers, but then healthcare information as well. And these charges come both for that and then also three unnamed companies that include a tech company, a basic materials firm, and a communications giant, as identified in the indictment. The indictment also had a few details on the attack. They said that they used spear phishing in the breach, and then they had remained in the network for actually several months during this breach, which I think brings up a point that you and I have highlighted a lot in a lot of the talks we've given over the past few years that breach detection in general is just pretty bad across the board right now in most industries.
Or is unused. And what we mean by breach detection is, I think when it comes to cybersecurity, everyone's about prevention. The first thing you and even we think about is installing all the security services to prevent things from happening. You know, firewalls to block access to certain services, anti-malware technologies and IPS to catch and block attacks, DLP, web filtering, all the typical things that are meant from preventing you from getting hacked in the first place. But what we mean by breach detection is that even if you have all those preventative services, nothing is perfect. You know, all the technology in the world doesn't prevent someone's kid from walking a virus in the front door on a USB key. So when we mention breach detection, we mean technologies that aren't trying to stop new attacks, but are somehow looking at your internal network, whether from a host and network level or both to combined, to kind of find malicious activity that's already on your network and to give you a clue that it's there. And I think whether or not the technologies suck, I think they're not used. I think everyone has...
That's what I meant by that.
Yeah, they focus so much of their budget, their security budget, on prevention that they have kind of overlooked this breach detection, which is another key aspect of your security strategy.
Yep, one of the numbers that we like to throw out is put on by the Poman Institute's data breach report. And in 2018... It took 196 days on average for companies to recognize they had been the victim of a breach. And that is a very substantial amount of time for someone to be sitting on your network stealing your data without you having any idea that it's going on. So you're right that I think that these breach detection technologies are really underutilized across basically all industries, because even massive healthcare provider organizations or insurance organizations like Anthem still had these attackers sit on their networks for months without them even knowing.
Yeah, and it's not uncommon. That same Poneman report says even though it will take you 196 days to find it, it'll probably take you another additional, I think it was 68 days just to clean it up. So it's unfortunately not too surprising. It took companies like Anthem a long time to find it. But meanwhile, it took them long, you know, even once they did find it, it's taken them years to investigate it too. You know, it's taken
it's
years.
It's been like 4 years, right?
Yeah. And that, by the way, could be tied to breach detection as well, because hopefully some of these services also have ways to log and give you more forensic information. And I think a lot of companies, if you're not storing logs or being more thoughtful about what you do store and how you back it up, you may not even have the information needed to do a forensic investigation.
And that's a really good point, because if you are the victim of a breach, understanding how it occurred is one of the first things you have to do in order to make sure it never happens again. And even if you catch the obvious stuff, like the phishing email that got them through the door, the piece of malware that they installed on the system that gave them remote access, if you don't have enough logs and even hire an expert to come investigate, you might miss some of the less obvious things, like a vulnerability in some application that you had no idea was still existing on one of your servers that could allow them right back in after you think you've patched everything up.
Or all the lateral movement. You know, really half the time these attackers aren't getting your critical database server right away. So they'd have to have done some lateral movement in your network to gain privileges they need to really get the pay dirt, so to speak. So for the lateral movement, that's where a lot of the interesting hacking techniques and where a lot of additional security controls, you could learn about ways you could resegment your network or change policy that really could have helped prevent some of the lateral movement in these attacks.
Yep. Still interesting seeing this breach come to somewhat of a resolution. I can't imagine, like, even though they're indicted, there's no way they're ever going to come to the United States and face trial. But it's good that it's good that the FBI and company are still investigating these attacks to try and find the culprits of them and try and hold them accountable.
I agree. I like seeing when the bad guys get caught or at least accused. You know, it's if this were just purely Wild West and these bad guys were never found, that would suck. It does, as you say, somewhat suck that they may not come to justice. but just the fact that they're being named, and it will prevent them from coming to the US, traveling the world easily, etc., etc. It's nice to see bad guys being caught instead of just anonymously getting away with this type of attack.
Agreed. Agreed entirely. And with that, let's move on to our fourth and final news story from the week. This one starts out with
it's a two-parter.
Came 2 weeks ago. It's a two-parter, and the first one kind of bugged the crap out of me when it happened.
You experienced this firsthand. You're kind of unlike a me who is still kind of a Chrome memory hog user. You're kind of a Firefox user, right?
Oh man, yes I am. I am one of the 10% of Firefox's browser share, mostly because I have some, I don't know, principles. I try and force competition in the browser market because I don't want to see Chromium take over everything.
That's
and
a
so
very
I am a
point.
Firefox user.
Yeah, I like that. I also like the Brave browser you use.
Yep, I like Brave, but unfortunately it also runs on Chromium. And that could be a whole other story, I think, of why browser competition is good. But anyways, me and other Firefox users experienced a rather annoying issue two Saturdays ago. We're on Saturday, March 4th. A certificate responsible for signing and verifying all extensions on Firefox's marketplace expired, which, long story short, meant that every single or just about every single extension that users had installed in Firefox started failing. This included quality of life things like NoScript and ad blockers. For me, it included my password manager, which made me realize how much I've come to rely on that thing, which I think is a good thing. But it also had some pretty scary issues where the Tor browser, which relies on Firefox, it had issues with NoScript running on that. And with Tor, you are very much using it for privacy protection and maintaining an anonymous presence on the internet. And once NoScript starts failing and JavaScript's allowed to execute in that browser, it makes it much easier to de-anonymize someone using the Tor browser. Now, Firefox was quick to release an update. I think it came out Sunday night or Monday or something. It wasn't automatic, so if you haven't updated your Firefox browser yet and you're wondering why everything is still failing, make sure you go do the update now. But I think this was an interesting issue, and I am a little bit disappointed in their development team that they didn't identify a failing or a expiring certificate.
Yeah, this is one where on one hand you want to say shame, shame, because it seems like such a simple thing. But on the other hand, I've seen many companies do it. Especially companies nowadays, you tend to have to be strategic and defensive with your domain registration. Meaning you have to kind of register a lot of domains, and maybe you need certificates for many of them. So keeping your certs up to date is, it can be a challenge if you're not paying attention. But it is kind of sad, a huge company that makes a browser which is entirely based on web and is pushing things like certificate standards and SSL TLS standards forgets their cert and has all these crazy implications because of it.
Yep. Luckily, they jumped on it pretty quick and fixed it. But boy, was that an annoying 24, 48 hours for me and I'm sure other Firefox users. The second part to our Firefox news story, though, is actually some really good news. On Thursday of last week, Mozilla, the company behind Firefox, announced a new funding research grants available for several different topics. And one of them, I think, is actually really interesting. They have a research grant available for people, companies, organizations that can find a way to make Tor work better with Firefox. So Tor being the Onion router, the Tor browser is actually built on a modified version of Firefox right now with additional privacy configurations, things like NoScript pre-installed and enabled by default. But one of the issues that Tor faces is that these modifications and just the Tor network in general really slows down connections that go through this browser. If you ever tried using the Onion browser, even to browse the normal internet, not even the dark web, you'll notice it takes a long time for pages to load. It really feels like the early 2000s, late 90s all over again. So Mozilla is looking for people to try and make this integration better and speed it back up so that they can eventually include Tor in the main Firefox browser as another little privacy checkbox that you can enable if that's a concern of yours. And I think this is actually a really good idea.
So meaning rather than putting all your traffic through the onion routing, you'd have a mode in Firefox that you turn on, and then your browsing would simply be going through the onion network? Is that the
exactly.
gist?
Exactly. So
Brave
browser does something. Yeah, exactly. The Brave browser does something very similar to this right now, where you can open a new tab that has Tor routing enabled. So kind of like a privacy tab or an incognito mode tab in Chrome, where now you can open up one that is like hyper privacy mode, where all of your traffic goes through the onion network, which or anonymizes.
Let's be honest, yep. A real incognito mode, because anyone that knows about incognito knows that while it might delete some of your cookies or might remove some of your cookies and some of your history, it does not make you anonymous. It doesn't remove your routes. It doesn't prevent ISPs from super cooking you. So to be honest, incognito is only marginally incognito, whereas Tor, where you're bouncing through a bunch of peers and kind of are hiding all your network activity and where you're coming from, would be a much more real incognito mode.
Exactly. And we mentioned that drawback of privacy mode or incognito mode, I think one or two episodes ago, when we talked about how websites and companies track you across the internet. And we also chatted about the Onion Network and dark web routing quite a while ago, sometime last year, I think, where we went really into detail about how this works and how it does make you legitimately anonymous on the internet.
Yeah. No, I think it's a very cool idea. And by the way, kudos, Firefox has always been the browser of choice for if you download the Tor packages in the Tor browser, it really is a version of Firefox. So I've always kind of respected their support of the Tor network.
And I like that privacy really does seem to be becoming a mainstream topic. Like, we've seen Apple now for the last year or two and Tim Cook really focusing on privacy as one of their big cornerstones of their organization. Even Google's CEO took a bit of a privacy jab at Apple. I think his quote was something like, you shouldn't have to charge extra a premium for privacy, which was only a little ironic coming from Google's CEO. But
and then, speaking of irony, this new move to privacy probably has to do with these high-tech corporations watching Facebook in the news and Facebook in Congress. But to that point, to your point of privacy being a major topic, Facebook just had the F8 conference earlier this month. I followed it because I'm a VR nerd, but in his keynote, Zuckerberg started with privacy and started touting Facebook's dedication to it. I'm sure you're probably rolling your eyes, as I was when he said this, but it does show that high-tech companies realize that privacy is costing, it's taking money from their bottom line, so they have to pay attention to it.
I am the king cynic when it comes to mentioning Facebook and privacy in the same sentence. I do recognize they own WhatsApp, which was developed with privacy in mind. They do end-to-end encryption for communications across that application, which is great, but that doesn't actually stop the company that owns it, so WhatsApp or Facebook, from using the application itself to spy on or read conversations that go through it. So even if Facebook is looking at like end-to-end encryption as a potential privacy thing for their messaging systems, the cynic in me does just roll my eyes out the back of my head, basically. But who knows? I'll be proven wrong.
I kind of agree with you, but I the same logic you apply to Facebook unfortunately applies to Google and all the others. If you think the Microsofts and the Google are not using the big data that they're privy to, I think it's naive. Facebook's the one Facebook's the one that's been caught and was used in a political hacking, but the others are doing it.
Yep. So, I mean, what are your options if privacy is a concern of yours? The Onion router.
This is why we like. Good? Yeah, this is why we like Facebook and Tor, right?
You know, you say that, or you joke about that. Facebook does actually have a Onion address. Facebook exists on the dark web. If you really want to check your friend list on the dark web and instantly make yourself de-anonymized.
I guess the other choice is I am making my kind of my. urban survival cave for the zombie apocalypse. So just cut yourself off from the internet before it kills you.
Yeah, and you know what? We could probably end every single episode with that recommendation. Just turn off the internet, unplug it all, and go back to playing with sticks or something.
The only advice we know that we and our listeners will never take.
Exactly. So really interesting news week this week. Cool talking about it. Hopefully a little less dramatic next week. I guess we'll see. Something tells me that Baltimore isn't going to be the last ransomware attack, and Binance isn't going to be the last crypto exchange hack that we hear about this year, though.
Not at all.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at XORRO underscore. Corey is at SecAdept. And the both of us are at hashtag the 443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.
See ya.